So I would say that Narendra Modi, the BJP, and the organizations and the movements associated with them have a very different vision of what a democratic society should look like in India. So they are committed to the processes and the procedures of democracy, but not to the values of a liberal democracy, because they don't think Indians want liberal democracy. They don't think liberal democracy is appropriate given India's values. And again, this is their concept of what Indian values are.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy and the studios of WPSU on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam.
And I'm Jenna Spinelli, and welcome to Democracy Works. Talking about India today, guys.
So just in case you were thinking that there weren't enough countries that were acting in ways that were problematic from the point of view of democracy and Democrats, here comes another one, right?
And it's such an interesting one, too, because it's a fairly new democracy,
right?
And it's an extremely large democracy.
The biggest, yeah.
And it's a somewhat raucous democracy.
Right. And if you've been following the news at all, you've heard about Kashmir and what happened there. And if you're like us, you don't know exactly what that means and how it comes about. You don't know the history. We figured it was the right time to bring in yet another expert.
Yeah, and luckily we have a great guest with us today to help unpack that. Vanita Yadav is an associate professor of political science at Penn State. And as you'll hear, really an expert on all things Indian politics.
As we've seen in some of the other episodes we've done on Brazil and Hungary and Brexit, there are some really uncanny similarities in all these countries and kind of that, you know, what we call it, the authoritarian playbook. But there's also some really interesting and important distinctiveness in all these countries, and that's especially true with India.
Well, sure, that's what we're trying to get at with all these different shows is following along a bit with early guests of the podcast from How Democracies Die, the best-selling New York Times book, that there's a sort of playbook here,
right,
or kind of pattern in how countries move toward authoritarianism from their democratic roots. In other words, through democracy,
right,
they become more authoritarian, but also by interviewing experts in these countries to be sure we pay attention to what's unique about them.
Right. And the only other thing I would add to that is not just that the playbook seems to be very similar, but also it's worth thinking about what is it about these countries that is the same in regards to why it's a fertile ground? What's happening now that makes it I guess that's the first question. Is it different now? But it seems to be, you know, the consensus is that there's a kind of, you know, widespread democratic erosion. And if that's true, why? What is it about these cultures that are in so many ways so different that is creating the possibility for creeping authoritarianism?
Yeah, or if there's a sort of contagion effect going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm going to learn a lot about India listening to my colleague Vanita today, but certainly I'm struck that this has been a fast-growing economy, one of the fastest-growing economies in the world, I believe. It does not, to my knowledge, have massive immigration. It's fairly homogenous, at least in terms of a strong Hindu majority. Of course, there are all these issues with Kashmir, and I know Vanita's going to speak to those. But it did have me thinking: what is the common element here? And it's, you know, maybe it's just a recognition that this is where democracy may be leading us, at least in many places. I mean, this is part of the point of how democracies die. Governments are elected democratically and then lead in a non-democratic direction.
Yeah, they're using the tools of democracy, right, to advance some of these populist nationalist ideas.
And that is certainly what I think is common about the case in India.
Right.
What I can't really get a handle on as much as the underlying causes.
Right. The last thing I'll say to maybe transition here is the other thing that is worth keeping an ear out for in this interview is Vanita also talked about what we often refer to as the guardrails of democracy, things like the free press and the courts and the status. Those there, as you might have picked up even just from the first couple minutes, they're not that great in some respects. But she also talks about the kind of strong culture of civil society and of organizing. So all those kind of things to keep an ear out for. If it sounds like we talked about a lot, it's because we did. But Vanita covered it all very well, and I'm very excited for you to hear my conversation with her. So let's get to it. says Jenna Spinelli here today with Vanita Yadav. Vanita, thanks for joining us on Democracy Works.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So we are going to be talking all about democracy in India today. And this is not a history podcast, but I thought in this case it might be helpful to start with a bit of history. India, while it is the world's largest democracy, is also a relatively young democracy, at least compared to some other places around the world. Can you start by giving us an overview of how India came to be a democracy and maybe how that history affects how people view democracy there?
So India is a relatively new country. I mean, it's an old civilization, but it didn't really exist as a country before 1947. So the British colonized that part of Asia for about 200 years. And when they left, that territory was divided up into India and Pakistan. And India and Pakistan, sort of the leaders gained experience under British colonial rule with parliamentary governance, because after the Government of India Act, there were elections, parties were allowed. And so the leadership of both of these countries actually had experience with elections. And so the parliamentary system was really something they were familiar with and had sort of competed successfully in. And so that was adopted in India in 1950. And India has kept the same constitution, the same parliamentary system through its entire post-independence period. It's also one of the rare developing countries that has actually maintained a democratic regime for its entire existence. And the quality of that regime has varied quite a bit, mm-hmm. but it has maintained itself as a democratic regime. It's a very robust multi-party system. It's always been a very robust multi-party system. It's got a very strong free press. Again, something that changes over time. And I think one of the unique things about India is that voter turnout is actually higher in rural areas than it is in urban areas. And that tells you something about how deeply democratic values, norms, and practices have really sunk in into ordinary citizenry. So there is sort of this very deep understanding that we have the right to vote. And it's, you know, and people do sell their votes, but they understand the value of a vote. So in many ways, it's a very robust democracy. In many ways, it's a very flawed democracy.
Yeah. So on that continuum you mentioned earlier of kind of the health of democracy ebbing and flowing over the years, where would you put it today as we sit here in 2019?
So I think it's definitely part of this larger global trend where democratically elected regimes are undoing a lot of the liberal protections and liberal rights and weakening institutions. So Poland, Hungary, Turkey, among developing countries. And in the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years, India has become part of that unfortunate trend. If you look back at history, it's not the first time this has happened in India. We had a period like this in the 1970s through the early 80s. But it's definitely, I would say, declining as a democracy right now.
Mm-hmm. And so thinking about the kind of strength of democratic norms, as you mentioned, you know, people coming out in rural areas to vote, that all seemed to have happened pretty quickly over a generation, two generations at most from the time the country and the constitution were established. Do you have a sense of how that spread and maybe how it spread so quickly or why it spread so quickly?
From 1947, when India gains independence, till about 1969, you have leaders who are genuinely committed to democracy. And so, you know, we have a lot of theories about how political parties are sort of the school where voters and leaders are schooled into democratic values and practices. And I think India really demonstrates mm-hmm. that. I think India was very lucky in having a good set of leaders who were genuinely committed to democracy.
Yeah. And so now thinking about Narendra Modi, is it safe to say that he does not share that same commitment or the strength of a commitment to democracy that maybe some of his predecessors had?
So I would say that Narendra Modi, the BJP, and the organizations and the movements associated with them have a very different vision of what a democratic society should look like in India. So they are committed to the processes and the procedures of democracy, but not to the values of a liberal democracy, because they don't think Indians want liberal democracy. They don't think liberal democracy is appropriate given India's values. And again, this is their concept of what Indian values are.
Yeah, can you explain to listeners what the BJP stands for and kind of what the party symbolizes?
Sure. So the BJP is the Bharatiya Janata Party. It is a right-wing religious fundamentalist party. And it was created in the mid-1980s, but it's sort of the continuation of this family of religious parties that has existed from pre-independence through all of the earlier democratic decades. And it has a platform that envisions Indian society and Indian government as being based on Hindu values. And that means the way you define rights, what state policy should be about, the way institutions should work, how the values and practices the institutions should protect, all of these stem from their idea of what Hinduism is. And Kashmir and, you know, sort of revoking Kashmir's special status in India, revoking a lot of rights given to minority religious groups has been part of that agenda from the beginning as well.
Yeah, it's something like 80% of India's population is Hindu. Does that sound right to you?
So it's about 80% Hindu, about 14% Muslim, which makes it the fourth largest Muslim country in the world. And it's about 2% Christians, less than 2% Sikhs. So every religion in the world is represented. Mm-hmm. But it's predominantly a Hindu country in terms of its religion.
Mm-hmm. So given that, I mean, is it surprising at all to think that like something like this Hindu nationalist movement didn't happen sooner, maybe? Or is there something about other things that are going on in culture, in the economy, other factors that might have made now or the past couple of years an opportune time for this movement to kind of rise up and gain traction?
So there's always been a strand within the population as well as within the political establishment that has disagreed with the division of British India into India and Pakistan. And the same group of parties and institutions, parties and organizations, have always argued that India is a Hindu civilization, the state should be based on Hindu values and principles. And they have mobilized from the earliest days and, you know, competed. And they've actually done reasonably well. So if you go back and look at the 50s and the 60s, they were winning about 10% of the popular vote, which is quite a bit. India has a first-past-the-post electoral system, so that's a big share of the vote. And so there has always been a political voice for that opinion. The BJP has been the most successful among that voice. And there are a lot of reasons that people have put forward for this. They've been succeeding since the 1980s, and this is the first time, so India had elections in 2019, and this is the first time that any religious party, including the BJP, has actually won back-to-back terms. So that is really, I think, a sort of a turning point, perhaps, in India's political history. Now, why did this happen now? I think for that, you have to look at a couple of things, the entire political party system and what's been happening with political parties in India in general. And so the BJP has stood out as one of maybe two parties that actually has a clear ideological sort of platform, has very strong party organizations, has very committed workers, and, you know, has sort of stood up for some principles consistently over time. And so the BJP's reputation as being relatively corruption-free, having a coherent agenda that they can clearly demonstrate commitment to, and sort of having this very effective grassroots-level organization.
What is the vision that they're selling to their prospective voters or to the kind of population at large?
What is, I think, unique about the BJP, and they're one of the few parties to have done this, is they were so effective in projecting this image of competence and being corruption-free and having this coherent agenda that they did what very few other parties have done, which is support for them crossed caste lines, mm-hmm. and caste is sort of a way of looking at ethnicity in India. They had people from lower caste supporting them. They had people who were highly educated, less educated supporting them. They had people from different religious groups supporting them. They had urban and rural groups supporting them. So they are one of the very few parties in maybe the last three decades, maybe one of two parties that has been able to develop that kind of coalition that cuts across class and religion and caste in India.
Yeah, we heard something similar. We did an episode earlier this year about Brazil, and I think Bolsonaro and his party had built kind of similar coalitions across economic lines, across caste lines, things like that. So speaking of those kind of authoritarian leaders, you mentioned Hungary, Poland, you know, we can certainly put Brazil in there. So all these countries are in kind of democratic backsliding. But there's in all of those, they kind of point to the leaders as a big piece of that, the fact that they have these authoritarian, strongmen kind of leaders. Mm-hmm. Would you put Modi in that category with Orban and Erdogan and Bolsonaro and those folks?
No, I think that would be mischaracterizing what's happening in India. In India, Modi is the face of a party and, importantly, of this organization called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is a hardline religious Hindu fundamentalist NGO, which is kind of the strength behind the BJP party. And it is really the party's turn at par, and it's really the party's agenda. And the RSS is driving the party's agenda. So this is not Modi's personal authoritarian tendencies. This is really the RSS and the BJP's agenda and their idea of what democracy looks like. And these are people who have an authoritarian influenced agenda. And so that's why you see that coming across from Modi. But Modi, I think saying that this is, you know, that Modi is similar to Erdogan would be giving him too much credit. It's more systemic.
Yeah. Well, and I think maybe more dangerous, too, in some ways, because, you know, leaders come and go, but the party has much more infrastructure in place. They've already won a second term and could conceivably win many more than that if things keep going their way.
And this is the fear in India right now, is that, you know, we had a dominant party system in the 1960s and the 1970s till the mid-80s. And that did a lot of damage to democratic institutions and practices. And the concern now is that that is the same thing is happening now, because, again, there is no effective opposition party. And so the BJP, between its reputation and its genuine sort of organizational capacity, can really perpetuate this for a long time. And they are systematically dismantling voices of opposition. So NGOs that are secular or that support women's rights or rights for religious minorities that they disagree with. The media has been very effectively captured, and they are actually going after the handful of channels that are still neutral or are critical of the government. So you see a similar pattern, that they're maintaining the processes and the institutions because that gives them democratic legitimacy. But you see very clearly that you have a dominant party system emerging that can perpetuate itself both because it has genuine popularity and because it has the capacity to capture these institutions and keep that capture going for a long time.
Right. So I know you were just in India this summer. So if there's not that support coming from an opposition party perspective or that kind of place of support, is there anything happening on the ground at kind of the grassroots level to try to push back against some of these forces?
So this has been India's saving grace so far, I think, is that it does have a very vibrant civil society. And so you have groups organizing on every issue under the sun and from very different angles. So you still have leftist groups. You still have very, you know, extremely conservative, you know, fiscally conservative pro-market groups. You have everything in the middle. And so the civil society groups really have been the key force of opposition. Now, it's a federal country, so there are political parties that exist at the regional level that have defeated the BJP. So if you look at the southern states in India, most of them are ruled by regional political parties. And if you go along sort of the eastern coast, you see the same pattern, that the regional political parties that are holding on to power. How long that lasts is the question, because the center does have a lot of authority, even within the federal system. And the BJP has been very flexible and very sophisticated about building alliances with regional parties when it realizes that it can't just win an election outright. And just to give you one sort of sense of this is, if you look at, you know, even 2013, when the BJP was already in power, that was its first term, 2014 to 2019. So just before it came into power in 2013, there were only 5 out of 29 state governments that were BJP ruled. There are 20 today. So they have really expanded.
Yeah. And what's their selling point to those smaller governments, those state governments? How have they been able to expand so quickly?
Well, I mean, the one thing is, if they are holding the center down, then they control a lot of the resources that states crave, right? And that's a very that's a very attractive thing. And then there's a negative veto power, right? So if the states want to initiate some policies, the center can very effectively veto them, not de jure, at least, in practice, they can't stop states from doing a lot of things. They control the appointments to governorships, and governors also have influence, which can be very critical in the formation of governments at the state level. So there are lots of little levers that they can use to make life really miserable for state governments that are opposed to them, or, help state governments stay in power and increase their ability to stay in power if they ally with the BJP. Mm-hmm. And again, I think the BJP's organizational capacity and their willingness to share this with their partners is huge.
Yeah. So you mentioned Kashmir briefly earlier. I know that you were there when a lot of that activity happened over the summer. Given how quickly the news cycle moves these days, it's easy to forget sometimes what exactly happens or lose some of the details. Can you help remind us what happened there with Kashmir and the BJP and kind of where things stand now?
So, if I can just give a little bit of history on Kashmir. So Kashmir has been sort of this unfinished business from the earliest days of independence. It was a princely state. And when the British Empire was being divided, princely states were given the prerogative to choose to be independent or become part of India and Pakistan. And Kashmir was unusual because it was a Muslim-majority state with a Hindu king. And so while the king was trying to decide what to do, Pashtun tribals invaded from Pakistan, supported by Pakistan. And when the king asked the Indian government to intervene, he was basically told he needed to accede or sign the instrument of accession for the Indian army to help out. And so that's what happened. But that instrument did not commit the kingdom to agree to the constitution of India at all. And, India went to the UN in 1948-49. And the resolution that came out was that there should be a plebiscite, which would allow Kashmiris to choose independence, Pakistan, or India. And India agreed to this, but the plebiscite has never been held. And so there has been sort of, a low level of discontent with that fact. But Kashmir didn't really sort of blow up as an issue until 1988. And that's when there were massively rigged state elections. And that sort of tipped the balance into militancy. So there's been a holding pattern from 88 to now. And that holding pattern has meant sort of a lot of domestic as well as foreign terrorist groups in Kashmir and the Indian Army stepping in with massive human rights violations on both sides. So that holding pattern is what was stopped. So there's something called Article 370, which granted Kashmir special status, which basically ensured that Kashmir could have its own constitution, could legislate its own laws, except for a few areas, and allowed them to regulate the rights of their own citizens. And what happened on August 5th of this year is that the BJP government used a presidential ordinance to revoke that. And so they did two things. They revoked the article, which takes away Kashmir's special status, and they split the state into sort of two regions. Jammu and Kashmir would be one. Jammu is predominantly Hindu, Kashmir is predominantly Muslim, and another state, which would be Ladakh, which is Buddhist. And they were sort of downgraded from being a state to being union territories. And that means they are now going to be governed directly by the center. And every facet of the Constitution of India is now applicable to them. So they are completely governed by the Indian Constitution and laws. And so there's still a debate about whether this is legal or not. This whole process was accompanied by complete suspension of the media, of the ability to assemble. Phone lines were cut. The internet was cut. And this was done before the announcement. And some of these have been lifted since then. Some of these sort of suspensions are still in place. So the process itself has been marked by this complete disregard of the very constitutional rights that are now being applied to the Kashmiri population. It's a position that's been supported by most in the BJP, by some leaders in the Congress, which is a secular party, and also by some Indians for different reasons. Some for the reason that a Muslim-majority state should not be getting a special status, and they should have the same status as every other Indian state. Some because they sincerely believe that it has held back Kashmir from fully sort of emotionally, socially, economically integrating into India. But I think support for the way in which it is done is non-existent outside the BJP and the RSS.
Yeah, and there were also massive protests, right, as all of this was unfolding in August?
So there were no protests in Kashmir. There were a lot of protests by secular parties, by leftist parties, by, you know, regional parties, by other civil society groups in India. Most TV channels, again, at this point are captured. So there wasn't a lot of critical analysis or critical debate about this. And the debate about Kashmir has become so couched in terms of patriotism and nationalism that if you were to support a position that says perhaps a plebiscite should be held, or perhaps Kashmiris, are being, mistreated and should be, you know, made to feel in a positive way that they're citizens of India, you can be accused of treason. And it's happening all the time. And people have been arrested for taking positions like that. So the environment's become very poisoned and the debate's really been shut off.
Does the BJP have control of the courts as well, or are they independent?
The Supreme Court is still independent. The lower courts less so. But there has been an escalating battle in the last, I would say, maybe 2 to 3 years, where it's very clear that the BJP is trying to get its own people appointed. So there is, the fight has been on. And the question really is whether there's enough support in civil society, in the press, to help the Supreme Court and the higher courts sort of maintain their independence. But at this point, it's not clear whether that will happen or not.
We've seen recently Modi and Donald Trump appearing together in the U.S., the Howdy Modi rallies. What does Trump see in Modi and vice versa? What might Modi see in him? Or what are kind of the lines or kind of the links between those two figures?
The relationship is interesting because ideologically, I think Modi and Trump do have a lot in common. They are both leaders who have competed on platforms which talk about how the common man has been alienated from their own culture, from their own values, either by immigrants, in India's case, perhaps by global culture and the invasion of Western culture. And they also have sort of a shared, I would say, distrust or animosity towards different religious minorities, notably Muslims. They are also both people who would be in the sort of my country first category. But I think the U.S. has the luxury of actually pursuing that. India is not a big enough country to be able to pursue that. Where they differ is that Modi and India cannot afford to and do not want to be protectionist. So that is one very important point of difference. They also share a platform on immigration. So India has also taken up immigration as a banner issue in the last 2 years under Modi, and it's been misused to disenfranchise or deny citizenship to some Muslims in some cases in specific states. So there is a lot in common, I think, ideologically. Now, the idea of representing the common man, this is really coming from the fact that in both countries, growth has not necessarily led to the betterment of the educated middle income or maybe the blue collar workers. So in India, for example, right now, 1 in 6 persons with a bachelor degree or higher is unemployed, right? And that's in a population where literacy is 70%. Right. So there has been growth, but there are very significant shares of the population that have not been part of that growth story. In India's case, 70% of India is still rural, close to 70%. And the rural areas have really been stagnant. There's been some growth, but very little. So there's a huge population of voters who do not feel that their lives have improved. At the same time, they're seeing the urban areas, the more globalized parts of the economy, you know, go past them and go above them at a very high speed, right? So they are culturally transforming into a more globalized, more westernized population. And economically, they are living lives that are significantly better. There's more security, right? And so the vast majority of voters in India share with, I think, a substantial minority of voters in the U.S. this belief that the country is not speaking to their concerns and to their problems, whether that's economic or whether that's cultural.
Yeah. Right?
And so they're appealing to the same concerns, I think, both on the cultural and economic front.
Yeah, that's so interesting to think about the rural voters. On the one hand, they feel like they're being left behind, but also they vote in much higher numbers, mm-hmm. it seems, which that's a unique combination. I don't think I've heard. I mean, I'm sure it exists other places, but I've not heard it framed particularly that way anywhere else before.
So this is it's a very strong lesson for the BJP, because what happened is, from 1999 to 2004, the BJP served out a full term where it did very well economically. It initiated a lot of economic reforms that really pushed India's growth forward, and then it campaigned in 2004 on a slogan of India Shining, which tried showcasing, you know, all of these sort of market-based accomplishments. And they lost very badly. And the reason they lost is because their reforms had not addressed rural concerns. So they really got the message in a very sort of strong way, right? They lost an election they could have won. And so this time they have come back very aware of the fact that they need to be speaking to rural voters on, you know, on every level that they can. Mm-hmm.
So where do you think things go from here? I know you don't have a crystal ball. You're not can obviously predict the future. But based on your research, your familiarity, your kind of sense of where politics are, where do you think we are a year from now, 5 years from now?
So I think the floor of my expectations would be that India would continue. It will continue as, you know, an electoral democracy. Elections will be held. They'll be reasonably fair. People will continue to participate. But I think unless there is either a single party or a set of party that really emerges that has the same organizational capacity as the BJP to mobilize people, unless that happens, what we will see is the BJP in power and the BJP weakening a lot of the rights and liberties and checks and balances that we take for granted. And given what's been happening in the last 2 years, so we're seeing minorities being lynched, and you know, women being checked for doing things that in terms of participating in education or jobs or behaviors or clothing that's inappropriate. We're seeing curbs being placed on the press, on civil society. We're seeing institutions like the judiciary and educational institutions being stacked with ideologically compatible appointees. Unless there is a rival, either at the national level, or there's a network of rivals that are successfully challenging the BJP at the state level, I see procedures going forward, but not strong institutions, not strong civil liberties. So I think it's a really dangerous sort of point in time right now.
Right. Well, certainly so much more we could unpack here, but I know we have to wrap up. This has been very helpful for me. Hopefully it has been for our listeners as well, kind of learning where things are in India and where they might go from here. So, Vinita, we will leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
So, thank you, Jenna, and thank you, Vinita. Terrific interview.
She really knows her stuff.
Yes, not at all surprised really by the good quality of that interview, having worked with Vinita for a number of years. A couple things struck me here in terms of what we've talked about with other countries and trying to think about what's kind of similar here in India from Vinita's perspective and what's different. And, you know, two things that struck me about what's similar with some of the other countries we've talked about is the attack on the liberal part of liberal democracy.
Mm-hmm. Civil rights, separation of powers, independent sources of power, that sort of thing.
Yes, the way they've gone after other sources of countervailing power, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, they've gone after universities. They've gone after the press. They're trying to stack the judiciary.
Right.
This is a playbook we've seen
in
many places.
And again and again.
And also, I guess, the sort of populist emphasis on ethnic identity and a kind of sense of belonging versus outsiders. In this case, having to do with a kind of more having to do with Hinduism and Muslims.
And Islam, yeah. I mean, so it is interesting to me how so often, maybe more often than not, religion is presented not as a set of values or even beliefs or this is how we expect ourselves to behave. It's fundamentally a sense of identity. It's a way of saying we're in and you're out. And in, you know, you're talking about Hinduism, you know, which is just this vast array of beliefs and expressions. And what unites everybody in this present manifestation, in this political manifestation, is that what we're not is Muslim. We're not Christians. We're not Buddhists. We're not Sikhs. And so this is, and then this idea, this identity becomes an essential dimension of what it means to be Indian.
I thought she also pointed to something else that was somewhat different from some of the other cases we've talked about, where you have an individual leader who uses sort of populism, uses democracy to take control and then turns in a more authoritarian direction, but it's coming from that leader.
And it's individual, and there's something
that
kind of cultish.
She makes an important point there that this is really the party.
Right.
Modi is just a member of that, the leader that party.
And
now, this may be the Republican Party in the future, but it wasn't necessarily before Trump.
True. And the very fact that they don't have that kind of identification with a personality means it's got a more staying power going forward, right?
Very possibly.
But,
yeah.
But the other thing that I thought was really interesting is this idea that unites Trump and Modi, that you, the good Hindu Indian, and you, the good middle-class American who reflect these values in your person and in your behavior, have been left behind by something in the way this country's going.
Yes.
Right? And so in the United States, it's that, you know, for whatever reason, if it's immigrants or a liberal elite, you salt-of-the-earth Americans should rightly feel betrayed, that you're doing everything you're supposed to do and yet you've been left behind. And in India, it's this sense that all this economic development doesn't seem to be trickling down to you, and all this Western influence is undermining what makes our country effectively Indian. And it's a very, very common and very
yes.
powerful strategy. I do think the idea that there's a common sense of you cannot just appeal to one subset of
yep.
a country like that and be successful.
Yes.
You have to
you
move
build
beyond
a
that.
Build a coalition.
Yeah, yep. Right.
Well, this is all very – I learned a lot today.
Yeah, a terrific interview. And we are so lucky to have people like this in Penn State. And it is worth – coming, I mean, just thinking, I mean, it's the oldest.
I feel like we should end on a we are chant.
Yeah, so it's the oldest teaching ploy in the world is to write a paper or sign a paper where you say, compare and contrast these two things. But it's really useful in this case, right? Because there's something big going on at a worldwide level, but yet there's something distinctive and distinctively important about every little example of it. So, I mean, that's, I guess, what we're trying to do. And we appreciate all of you for listening.
All right. So from the McCourney Institute for Democracy, I'm Michael Berkman.
I'm Chris Beam. Thanks for listening.